But while at the Art Institute, there was a teacher of mine, art historian Bill Berkson. And Berkson is a very well-known poet. And he told me one night to go to this poetry reading. And I was like, poetry? I'm not even interested in poetry. Why would I want to go to a poetry reading? He's like, ah, it's just down at the Cowell Theater. It's not far from here. If you're not doing anything, come check it out. So I didn't have anything going on, so I went to this poetry reading. And it turns out it's the release party for the Norton Anthology of Postmodern American Poetry. And I go to this thing. It's at the Cowell Theater in San Francisco. And Diane DePrima is there, and Ron Padgett, and just a host of all these amazing American icons of poetry. And I am just floored. There's visual poetry. There's poetry as song. There's just all the, this whole world of possibility in language unfolds before my eyes and my ears and my whole body. And I freaked. That was it. Because Paul Hoover introduces the whole night by sharing this line from Jack Spicer, who was a great Berkeley Renaissance poet from the 1950s. And Spicer is in the anthology, long dead at this point, but Paul Hoover shares this line, which is, "The poet builds a castle on the moon made of dead skin and glass." The poet builds a castle on the moon made of dead skin and glass. And I was like, what? That's the craziest, weirdest, most beautiful thing I've ever heard. I want to do that. I want to have that kind of strange imaginative power. And I wasn't accessing that with photography. And so that was it. That night, that was my night of, with the night of the lightning bolt. And I just wanted to write poems. I wanted to get into this poetry thing.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before we start, I just want to share two quick things with you. If you have guest recommendations or stories that you think we should know about, shoot us an email at hello@unmistakablemedia.com. We love hearing from our listeners. And if you're looking for a keynote speaker for your event or want to bring our team at Unmistakable Creative to your event or organization for a workshop on creativity and productivity, visit unmistakablecreative.com/speaking, send us the details, and we'll be in touch. And as always, today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. Whether you're looking to start a new website or move an existing one, HostGator can help. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy, and if you want to move from an existing host to HostGator, they make it free and super simple. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Albert, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Delighted.
Yeah. So, I actually was introduced to you because you wrote in, and I had a chance to do some digging on your work as a writer. And it's always cool to see people who've made multi-decade careers as writers. I think that we have a lot to learn from people like you, especially for those of us who've only been at this for a short time. And it's funny because in the world that we live in today, 10 years is actually a short amount of time. So I want to start by asking you, just based on having read your memoir, what social group were you a part of in high school, and what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
That's a great question. What social group? In high school, it was interesting, because I came out of these 2 years. I was at this junior high school in New York State, which was, I was sort of yanked from my childhood home, kicking and screaming, basically. Grew up in Connecticut, and then we moved right at sixth grade. And so I found myself several miles away, but not far enough away to be totally removed from my old friends. We just moved over the border into New York State and ended up at this junior high school, public high school, and just was, basically cried for 2 years and was miserable, missed all my old friends, blah, blah, blah. And the flow was that I would just go to the public high school there. But I wanted to be back in Connecticut. So I ended up applying to this private day school in Connecticut. And somehow I got in. And back in the day, this school, which is now much better, was kind of like for all the reprobates and people who'd gotten kicked out of prep schools and so forth. So I kind of fit in pretty good. And it had kids coming from Connecticut, from New York, kind of from a wide geographic area. There wasn't the social groups. Everyone, it was a small school, and we only had 60-something kids in our class. Uh-huh. And there weren't that many broken up, isolated groups as such, social groups. Everyone seemed to show up at the same parties. You know, I mean, there's sure there were the geeks and the jocks and the preps and the stoners, and I kind of hung out with just about everybody. Mm-hmm. At some one point or another. I mean, I tended to lean, if I was honest with myself, I would lean toward maybe the preps and jocks, but I was also a stoner. I also was really into the Grateful Dead. And so that's sort of the, if I had to pin a group,
yeah,
that would be it. Unpinning a group.
Yeah, I am curious, having been educated in a group of such, in such a small student body, what is different about that than what a typical person experiences education-wise? How did that impact your perspective on education? What do you think of education today? And how did it shape your life as a writer and a creator and your career?
I guess it was, I felt pretty lost at being at this giant middle school. And easily lost within the cracks. And it's a small school like that, it's hard to get lost. It's hard to be isolated because people are always kind of pulling you in to various activities. And I mean, that's part of the private school ethos, is to be engaged in community and to build community. Whether that's, volunteering or showing up for the yearbook team, which I eventually did, or participating in after school sports. You kind of had to do all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas it was a little more optional in public schools. So there was a sense of engagement, and also socially we were so tight knit while we were at school because people were coming from all over the place. So we ended up really hanging out there for a long time. You get there at sort of 8 in the morning and you wouldn't leave until after your activities at 6 at night. And there was always something going on. There was a play going on. There was something happening at the gym. There was the yearbook. And I wasn't really a guy to participate much, but I found myself getting funneled into these things and wound up in the working with the yearbook people, because I took Miss Toth's photography class, and that was my first foray into creativity and art making, was photography. And I was probably junior year, I want to say.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it, and I like hanging out with the people who were involved with it, and there was an openness and a randomness and a spaciousness and a freedom that I didn't find in a lot of the academic work. I wasn't a great student. In fact, I was a pretty poor student. Mm. And I had a hard time expressing myself, period. But when the parameters were opened up, in the yearbook thing after school, anything went, and we could play and explore, and there was much more freedom there for me to land in a kind of creative zone.
Mm-hmm. I love this idea of having sort of open parameters to express yourself. I think I found that as a writer. I'm curious how photography influenced your writing and how writing has influenced your photography. What impact did each have on the other?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story in that I after high school, I got that camera. My dad got me a camera my senior year, and I went to to Europe that summer on a school trip and took lots of pictures, mostly snapshot stuff. But then when I got to college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I learned that you could major in photography. I was like, wow, major in taking pictures. Okay, I'll do that. Sounds good. And I got kind of into it. And I learned how to see, basically. I learned how to see the world in a creative way. I learned how to frame things. And I guess I always had a wild imagination. It wasn't really cultivated until college. But that imagistic style really affected my writing. You know, my earliest writing was always based on images, poetry. It's where I got my start as a writer. And so I think that learning to see and learning to frame things in a certain way and explore the wildness of the imagination through the image, the sensory image, was influenced my writing. It kind of gave me a place to land and explore. And that's some of my favorite writing. I mean, my favorite writers are ones who can bring you into that sensory experience that they're having, that triggers your own sensory experiences, which in turn become emotional experiences, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're trying to do as artists, is we're trying to translate emotional experiences and cultivate a field of empathy for our readers and for the world, ultimately. Mm-hmm. So that's where the photography basically influenced the writing. And where the writing influenced the photography, it also started showing up when I went to college and got a BFA, a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Photography, and then went on to the San Francisco Art Institute and originally majored in photography there. But, you know, in the photographs, words kept entering the photographs, and the titles became more and more important to me. And, you know, eventually the words kind of took over and there were no more photographs left. It was just words. And then I left after grad school. I left photography. I fell in love with poetry and I sort of never looked back.
So how, I mean, I know you teach writing workshops as well. I mean, this idea of learning to see, how do we do that? How do people develop that capacity in their own work, regardless of what the genre of the art form is? So, you know, I want to learn how to see as a podcaster, like I want to learn to see as an interviewer and see, you know, and create these visual images for people who are listening. But I'm sure, you know, this extends far beyond just writing, photography, and even the medium, you know, that we're speaking in right now. So I'm curious, how do you cultivate that capacity?
Well, I think it's a combination of two main things. One is ingesting a lot of visual work, you know, broadening your horizons as an artist, as a writer, taking in a lot of visual art, you know, looking at sculpture, looking at painting, reading about color and line and composition, and really starting to think about why things are framed in certain ways. What's up with the square? Like, why are paintings square? And what's up with the white cube of the gallery, and how are things contained? And then with conceptual art, how are things uncontained? How does just being a person in the world become a creative act? So that's part of it is, and I spent a lot of time and also had the benefit of growing up with parents who consumed a lot of art. They consumed a lot of visual art, a lot of architecture. My dad was an architect. A lot of photography, dance, theater. And so I was around all that stuff, and I never realized the power of that and the influence of that on my writing until much later. But so exposure, I think, is really important. The other thing is being in the world and mindfully tuning into your sensory experiences, whether that's visually, whether that's auditorily, whether that's with your sense of smell and taste, but really slowing down and stopping and being with, being present to. That's why I find meditation is such a powerful, powerful force for creativity, because it reminds us to engage fully in the immediate sensory experience that we're having. And then, you know, there's like endless exercises one can do to learn how to see better through, you know, just walking around with a cutout piece of cardboard, like a window, and looking through a window and framing things and see how things are composed in unique ways. And, you know, writing from photographs, writing from sculptures, writing during films, and these practices and these exercises, they help us see better. They help us get into our other sensory experiences and other creative experiences that can really influence the writing dramatically.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by Skillshare. Are you a professional looking to get a leg up at work, or just someone who loves to learn new things? Want to add some impressive skills to your resume? Skillshare is an online learning community with over 16,000 classes in design, business, and more. You can learn everything from logo design to social media marketing to street photography, and you get unlimited access to all of this for a low monthly price. You never pay per class again. In fact, some of my personal favorite Skillshare classes have been taught by former Unmistakable Creative guests. Seth Godin has an amazing course called the Modern Marketing Workshop, and Simon Sinek has a course about public speaking called Presentation Essentials: How to Share Ideas That Inspire Action. And there are literally thousands of other amazing courses on marketing, entrepreneurship, design, and much more. Skillshare is giving our listeners a month of unlimited access, absolutely free. So go to www.skillshare.com/create to redeem your free month. Again, that's www.skillshare.com/create to redeem your free month. Well, I want to spend a good amount of time talking about your personal story, because you know, it was so deep and it was so layered with so many different experiences. I mean, from the family dynamic to you know, I know that you've spent a good amount of time abusing substances, which is the sense I got from reading Beamish Boy, to get to this point of sobriety. So, can you walk us through you know, and you can tell me a 15-minute story, and that is totally cool, how you kind of, you know, went down this trajectory, and what is the role that writing and creativity had played in all of it? And, you know, how did it bring you to the point you're at now?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I'm just finishing up this new book is coming out. It's called Writing is a Path to Awakening. And it's about the writing journey, and it's about the spiritual journey too. Somehow I survived. You know, I grew up in an abusive and alcoholic family, and so by an early age I was, you know, I was a binge drinker, and there were a number of really terrible accidents. One of which I was, you know, I passed out drunk in a driveway, and I was run over by a best friend, and he just drove over me. A couple of years later, I wake up handcuffed to the bed rails of a hospital in Colorado. No idea how I got there, and I'm under arrest. And through most of that time, this was my late teens, early 20s. Through most of that time, I'm not creating anything. I'm not writing anything. I'm taking a few photographs here and there. And I'm just trying to stay alive somehow. You know, I'm trying to deal with the grief of this abuse, and I'm trying to numb it away, numb it out of my experience. And yet, and I don't, at this point, I don't have any consciousness really of the effect that the creative portion of my childhood has had, like my parents, and the fact that they were so interested in art, and there were so many books around, and I didn't read a lot of these books, but they were there, you know, and you sort of, they almost magically, they just kind of are imbued in you, right? And you're seeing your parents reading all the time. Like, my parents were never without books. They were like always reading. And so you pick up on that as a kid, and maybe it doesn't resonate, it doesn't show up in any way until, you know, until you're 30 years old, which was the case with me. But it's there, and it's influencing your experience all along the way. And so by my second terrible accident and arrest, that was do or die, literally. Like if I drank again, I was going to die. So by age 22, I got sober and moved to California. I moved there to start anew. And also I applied to the San Francisco Art Institute, and I end up getting into the Art Institute in San Francisco. I submit a portfolio of photographs that have words. There's some photographs I shot while I was in Africa my junior year in East Africa. I was there for 4 months and took tons of pictures and ended up sort of journal writing around on these photographs and then submitted them to the Art Institute thinking I would never get in. And somehow they took me. And so off I was to San Francisco, newly sober, still very much lost emotionally. And yet there's this thread of possibility. There's this thread of creativity. There's this sense that if I keep looking, if I keep I had just recently started writing. I kept this journal when I was in Africa and found it profoundly helpful. I had written letters. Remember letters? Back in the day, people used to write letters.
Yeah.
And, in the 80s and even the 90s, I suppose some people still write letters. It seems so quaint now. But so I wrote letters, and when I got to the Art Institute, there's a long story of arriving in San Francisco, finally realizing that I need therapy, and I joined this therapy group my new friend is in, but it turns out it's a psychedelic therapy cult, and I get sucked into the vortex of this cult, and they're doing tons of drugs, and there's no boundaries, and oh God, it's a nightmare, but not without its redeeming qualities of insight and revelation and letting go, and that's a whole nother thing. But at the Art Institute, I flailed around. I took pictures, I made paintings, I did performances, I shot little films, and by the end of my first year, my photo teachers were like, "Where's the portfolio? Like, where's the cohesive thing that we can pin you down to?" And I didn't have a thing. I was scattered all over the place. So they failed me. I failed my year-end review. And instead of staying in the photography department, I said, well, screw it. I'll just go to the new genres department. And I can do whatever I want in the new genres department. And so I put together and I had to resubmit my whole portfolio. So I put together some completely bizarre, crazed, performance-y installation thing. And only one of the teachers showed up. And he was like, well, it looks good to me. I think you're good. And so I ended up graduating just barely. But while at the Art Institute, there was a teacher of mine, art historian Bill Berkson. And Berkson is a very well-known poet. And he told me one night to go to this poetry reading. And I was like, poetry? I'm not even interested in poetry. Why would I want to go to poetry? He's like, it's just down at the Cal Theater. It's not far from here. If you're not doing anything, come check it out. So I didn't have anything going on, so I went to this poetry reading, and it turns out it's the release party for the Norton Anthology of Postmodern American Poetry. And I go to this thing, it's at the Cowell Theater in San Francisco, and Diane DePrima is there, and Ron Padgett, and just a host of all these amazing American icons of poetry. And I am just floored. There's visual poetry, there's poetry as song. There's just all this whole world of possibility and language unfolds before my eyes and my ears and my whole body. And I freaked. That was it. Because Paul Hoover introduces the whole night by sharing this line from Jack Spicer, who was a great Berkeley Renaissance poet from the 1950s. And Spicer is in the anthology, long dead at this point, but Paul Hoover shares this line, which is, "The poet builds a castle on the moon made of dead skin and glass. The poet builds a castle on the moon made of dead skin and glass." And I was like, what? That's the craziest, weirdest, most beautiful thing I've ever heard. I want to do that. I want to have that kind of strange imaginative power. And I wasn't accessing that with photography. And so that was it. That night, that was my night of, you know, with the night of the lightning bolt. And I just wanted to write poems. I wanted to get into this poetry thing. So I bought the anthology. I started finding my favorite poems, my favorite poets, started buying books, going to the library. And for my remaining time there at the Art Institute, Bill was just cheering me on. He was so excited to have a student who was interested in poetry, because he was such a great poet. And he would fill my mailbox with these Xerox copies of these classic books of poems that were long out of print, from people like Ted Berrigan and Alice Notley and all these amazing poets. And so I got a real education there, and it kind of took off from there. And I've been talking for so long, I forgot your question.
No worries. This has been really awesome. So many questions come from this, just kind of hearing the beginning of the story. One of the things that I'm curious about, and this is something that I think I personally have experience with this, and I know that I tend to do this. Why do you think that people tend to numb painful emotions with things like drugs or alcohol? Because I know I've done it. Like, I can honestly tell you that there are plenty of moments in my life where that was my default reaction.
I think it's a combination of fear. I mean, it's basically fear and terror. Like, in my experience, it was, you know, I got my ass kicked when I was a kid, and I didn't get the attention I needed and the connection and the love that's so basic and primary to human well-being. And so I missed that. I was so lost to it and so yearning to come back to connection, to love, basically. And I didn't think that I mattered at all. Like, no one ever told me I mattered. And so I numbed out. It was too painful. For me, it was like physically too painful to be alive at a certain point. And I think that's sort of, people have their own version of this. And hopefully, you know, a lot of people aren't, you know, traumatized and they didn't get their ass kicked. But we all know that so many people do. So many people do get neglected and do experience trauma and great loss. And especially in childhood, you know, you carry that your entire life. And so I think it's a way to just to disconnect. You know, I think showing up and being present in the world is really challenging for all of us. It takes this level of vulnerability. We have to be willing to feel the grief of the world. I mean, just being alive today is we're so inundated with information and trauma on every level. Just the way, you know, we're constantly hearing about the war in Syria or the war in Yemen or the war in Afghanistan or the war here or the war that. And yes, there's always been war, but there's never been this inundation and access, immediate access to the trauma of it and the information around it. And so I think people are feeling a little bit of PTSD, even if they weren't in the war. You know, just learning about that. If you're a sensitive, open person, you're just getting beaten down, and it feels safer to just numb it out, to just tune out and disconnect. Because otherwise you're stumbling around the world, your life, you know, crying all the time. You know, I mean, not that that's what happens when you're open necessarily. I think, you know, when you do get vulnerable, you do get real and you do get present, you open up also to a possibility of taking action, right? Your choices become more open and more broad. So I think to feel, to show up, to be present is to be courageous. And it's hard. It's challenging for most of us.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by Design Crowd. Unmistakable Creative listeners have used Design Crowd for logo, web, and graphic design. Here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you set up your design brief, and you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like the designs you get, you can then approve payment. If you don't like what you get, you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or ask for your money back. To see what other Unmistakable Creative listeners have designed and save $100 on your first project, visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for $100 off. Today's episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator. They host your website and they have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. An easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, one-click WordPress installs, and if you want to switch from an existing host to HostGator, it's free and it's simple. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting 30% off all of their hosting packages. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. How in your own life did you let go of the baggage from the past?
God, I mean, that's all part of the journey. That's the whole book. Yeah. Beamish Boy is that, you know, it's part of it was, you know, waking up in hospitals and trying, you know, getting that signal that, you know, you do this one more time, you're not going to be alive for it. Sometimes we're stubborn. You need to be really hit over the head or driven over by a car. And then all of it, a good therapist. You know, first I went to a bad therapist with no boundaries and with all these substances and psychedelics. And there was something to that that was also opening, you know, that also helped me transcend the difficulties of my childhood and the traumas and so forth. And then I got a good therapist. And, you know, I went to energy healers and I got massages and I started eating right and I started exercising and I started meditating. And meditation was a real game changer for me because that was the place that I found that this is where I'm really showing up. Like when you settle down your nervous system and you don't do anything except breathe and reconnect and look inside, it's a mind blower. It's a heart blower. It just opens you up to this vast sense of self that's so much more than you ever thought you were as a human being. And the true vulnerability seeps through and the true healing can be activated.
Wow.
So those are some of the things.
Yeah, funny enough, I found myself in a session with an energy healer, which I never thought in a million years I would do.
Right. I know it seems like a little bit too woo-woo and
yeah,
new agey and so forth. But, you know, in my experience, and I've just noticed this in relationship to the trauma I experienced as a kid and what my sisters have gone through versus what I've gone through in terms of healing. And I'm not a psychologist, but I do know that emotions and powerful emotions, deep trauma, it lives in the body. It's a physical embodiment, lives in the flesh and the bones of our bodies. And until we're willing to re-feel that and to deal with the energy of the body and release that, it's not going anywhere, you know, because we'll just cycle around in our heads about it forever. Uh-huh. We need that active, energetic reintegration and letting go to have happen.
Wow.
So,
you know, the other part of what you just said that really struck me was what you called the lightning bolt moment. And I'm curious, you know, how do people identify that moment in their life? I feel like we get multiple lightning bolt moments. I'm sure I've had them. I think the day that I was sent an email from my co-founder of the podcast, Sid Savara, saying you're a much better interviewer than you are a writer, was one of my lightning bolt moments.
Right.
But I'm curious, you know, how do you develop an awareness to recognize those moments when they show up in your life?
For me, it's always been in retrospect.
Yeah.
And, you know, bringing awareness to them, thinking about, I mean, this is the whole thing about self-reflection. that's really powerful and essential if we want to evolve as human beings. You know, if we want to evolve in our lives, we want to heal our lives, expand our lives, and make the world a better place through the portal that is us. You've got to investigate. You know, you've got to explore this sense of self. Who am I? You know, keep asking yourself, who am I? And you know, it helps to just stay engaged and always learning. You know, sometimes these lightning bolt moments have been revealed to me in like speaking workshops, you know, where you're asked to talk about that a life defining moment. You know, it's like, oh yeah, what was that life defining moment? So it can kind of happen anywhere. But as a writer, you know, as a creative person, those are often the points that are most pivotal and most interesting for people to read about. And so you're exploring those as part of the art making process. Mm-hmm. You know, and you think about like, okay, where are these points where I just really got sort of jolted into a new reality, a new sense of possibility for myself? Or it was like a major smackdown and I had to kind of reassess, retool, how am I going to move forward? So that's one thing about lightning bolt moments.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I wanted to ask you about is, you know, building a creative career that has sustained, you know, multiple decades. You know, I think that one of the things that's really interesting about the world that we live in today, and this is something I wrote in my book, I said, you know, our perception of longevity is actually really warped. We think that 1 year is a long time just because of the pace at which the world moves is so fast. And, you know, you hear people like Sam Altman over at Y Combinator say, you know, if you're serious about this, you know, you should be prepared to spend 10 years working on it. Uh-huh. And I'm very curious, you know, what advice do you have to people who are starting out early in creative careers? Like, what are the pitfalls that they face? You know, are there moments when maybe it makes sense not to pursue this path or to not keep going down it?
Well, I think it's devotion is one of the key things. The patience, devotion, consistency, staying with it. Because right, in the creative world, 10 years is not a long time. You know, there's a lot of my favorite writers, takes them 10 years to write their novel. It takes 10 years to write a good book, and that's difficult for a lot of us to sit with, because we want that instant gratification.
Yeah.
But when you're starting off on the creative path, it's just you got to get into that mode where you feel like, I really love to do this thing. This is like a fun thing for me to do. There's really not anything else I'd want to do than make photographs or write a book, or, you know, not that it's always going to be fun 24/7.
Yeah.
Because there's always going to be those aspects to anything that are challenging, that are a pain in the ass, blah, blah, blah. But just being devoted to that world of creativity that you find yourself in, and staying with it for the long haul. I mean, what is that? There's that oft quoted 10,000 hour, the 10,000 hours?
Yeah, I believe so.
A rule of just, you're just doing it all the time, you know, for a long time. And you put in that time, and next thing you know, you're pretty good at it. And it's like, wow, you get those little wins that keep you going. And I always wanted to participate. You know, it occurred to me at some point as an artist, like, why are there some people who are published and out there, you know, telling everybody what writing is or what photography is, and others that aren't? And it finally occurred to me that, oh, well, they don't get to define what photography in America is any more than I do. The only difference is that they've stayed with it. They've devoted themselves to it. They keep doing it. They keep engaging. They keep participating. on multiple levels too.
Did you ever want to quit?
Did I ever want to quit? In some ways I quit photography, you know, depending on how you define quit. I mean, I don't do much photography anymore. Mm-hmm. But I definitely didn't quit art, you know, and I can't not make art. I can't not make writing. I can't not write and make poems. And now it's novels, and it has been memoir, and who knows what it'll be next. But I can't not do it. You know, it's like this thing that's in me that I just love doing. I love engaging with. And, there's these waves of doubt that haunt us as artists and haunt me eternally. But, there's always what I find solace in is this return to the work itself and to the practice and process itself and to the love of poetry, to the love of novels, and to the love of even the love of photography. I still am a great admirer of photography. I don't practice it as much, but I love looking at photo books. I love going to photo shows. There's a great Dorothea Lange exhibition right now up here at the Oakland Museum. And it's just that joy and love to connect with the art and the art making process that keeps me never wanting to quit.
What would you say to somebody who in this moment right now is feeling like they want to give up?
I would say connect with the reasons that you got into it in the first place. You know, like for me, it was being turned on by that Jack Spicer quote. And so I would, in my darkest moment, I would return to that quote. I would return to that book of poems. And I would go there and read that again and be like, oh, yeah, that's why I got into this. That's because I love this. And I know that I too have a way of seeing the world that is important. And I just need to reconnect to that, spirit of creativity and that spirit of intention to participate from my own worldview, from my own experience.
You know, it's interesting. I'm really glad you brought up the idea of, you know, why did you start doing this in the first place? And I think that often in a world where we're inundated with input, our reasons for why we think we're doing something are often largely influenced by external, sources of information or people and ideas. Like, you know, people basically say something is a trend and suddenly you see everybody wanting to hop on sort of that bandwagon, and it kind mm-hmm. of neglects exactly what you're talking about, which, you know, to me leads to a great deal of creative dissatisfaction.
Yeah. No, in the comparison factor too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, especially, you know, with everybody is on Facebook and Instagram and they're sharing all kinds of stuff. You know, their chicken dinner from last night that they did a fabulous job on, and their latest novel. And, you know, the fact that you start to see, you know, all your friends or your friends of friends, and they're just churning out these novels and photo exhibitions and whatnot, it make you feel completely inferior. And so I think we need to keep that in check, you know, and bring our attention away from the social media stuff necessarily and more on the attention of creating, mm-hmm. spending that time. What, you know, as I always love to say, a writer is somebody who writes. That's it. I had a student, actually, I was teaching a writing retreat last week up here in Northern California, and a woman came up to me day five, and I had been spewing for, you know, these 4.5 days and all kinds of content and exercises and insights and so forth. And she said to me at the very end, she said, you know, this the biggest takeaway for me was that when you said a writer is someone who writes, I was like, yeah, that's it. You know, a writer isn't somebody who's published necessarily. A writer is someone who's committed to the practice of writing. That's it. So commit to the practice of writing and stop worrying about what everyone else is doing and focus on being the best writer that you can possibly be. If you want to be a writer, if you really enjoy this process, if you're really devoted to sharing your ideas in this way, just do it. Just shut up and write.
So on that note, I have to ask one other thing about this. What does your day-to-day routine and ritual look like?
So when I'm in the new writing mode of a book, like I'm creating a new book, like right now I'm not, because I'm in promotion mode for Writing as a Path to Awakening. And so I'm just like inundated with all of that. And that's part of being an artist, especially these days. You know, it's a multi-layered, multi-tiered process, and promotion and connecting with your readers is a huge piece of it. Excuse me. But when I'm generating and I have a new project going, I'm up really early at sort of 5:30, 6, which is 6 is kind of late. And then I'm on my couch with my notebook and I'm handwriting in my notebook. And I'm doing that for 20 minutes to 3 hours. And then I'm jumping on the computer and I'm typing things in, and I'm gathering and accumulating ideas. I'm accumulating material. And this can go on for months of just accumulating material. And it's different for each kind of a project. So that would be for like a memoir or prose or a novel, where I'm just I'm generating as much information and ideas as possible. And I'm starting to eventually shape them into a kind of form that I can work with. But that's really the routine. I'm done by, you know, 12 or 2 usually in that mode. And I just have to get away from my notebook and away from the computer and go ride my bike or, you know, go to the coffee shop or go connect with a human being. So that's the general generative portion of the program.
Yeah. No, I totally get it. It's funny. I think the interesting thing to me is, you know, setting aside time to actually shut down and go do whatever it is that often we think is wasting time. And yet those tend to be the moments in which we get a lot of our best creative insights.
Mm-hmm. And you have to find your own process.
Yeah.
Which is an act of discovery and experimentation. You know, when are you the most productive? Some people are productive at night. I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, I'm down for the count by like 8 or 9 o'clock. Just want to go to bed. And I mean, that's not always true too, right? We don't want to get too locked into our personality type or style, because interesting stuff can happen when we write at the off hours. And so kind of remaining open, you know, finding your little niche, finding your most productive zone, but also being willing to tinker a little bit, because sometimes you don't have the time. Like my wife and I had this home care business for a while, for about 7 years. And I had to write in the evenings. I had to write on the weekends. I didn't have the pleasure and the time and the space to get up at 5:30 and put in a couple of hours before work most days. You know, I had an hour and a half commute, and so I had to squeeze it in whenever I could. So it depends on your time, but there's always time, no matter how crazed you are. If you want to write, if you want to create, there's always time. You have to create that time the way you would create your characters in your book. You know, you are the creator. The ultimate artwork is yourself and your life. And so you invent that time and create it, whether it's 15 minutes before work or 15 minutes before you go to bed.
Well, I think you have filled this with a lot of poetic nuggets, as I kind of expected, having read your memoir. So I want to finish with my final question, which I know I've you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Makes them unmistakable. That's a funny word. Unmistakable. Like, as in you can't mistake them for somebody else?
Yeah, I would say so.
I think it's their willingness to be authentic. That's really it. Their willingness to be authentic. Their willingness to go inside, to be vulnerable, to open up to all the fear, the doubt, the terror, the beauty, the love, the joy, the insight. The full willingness to be that authentic self. That's what makes them unmistakable. Mm. You know, because then you're like in tune with your inclinations. Your inclinations to experiment, your inclinations to explore, to ask questions, to connect with others, and ultimately to change the world as only you can.
Well, I think that makes a fitting end to our conversation. Where can people learn more about you and your work?
Yeah, just albertflynndsilver.com. Or just hashtag writing as a path is another way.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.